Chapter 7. Year of Climaxes. For Ivan Pavlov, the International Physiological Congress of August 1935 was a lifelong dream come true. The former seminarian who'd been inspired by the people of the 1860s to pursue a life in science was now celebrated by an international gathering of his discipline and hailed as the prince of world physiology. Speaker after speaker praised his achievements. An army of current and former co-workers, many now masters of their own lab, presented the latest in conditional reflex, CR research. A steady stream of visitors attended his experimental demonstrations and marveled at Koltushi. Journalists from around the world pressed for an interview, and he was celebrated by Russia's grateful leaders. The emotional impact was all the greater because the Congress was much more than a personal achievement. It was the triumph of his scientific vision and of his homeland. It would have been unimaginable during Pavlov's youth, and the headiest of fantasies in 1914, that Russia, so long a scientific backwater, would proudly host an international congress for which the state spent unheard-of sums of money, treating delegates like visiting royalty and dispatching leading figures to address them, while the country's newspapers breathlessly covered the gathering. Cheering crowds saluted the visiting scientists, and the world's leading physiologists from the United States, Europe, Great Britain, and Japan shared their astonished admiration at the country's new scientific facilities and scientific cadres. The grim international scene provided additional drama and significance. Having underestimated for years the unique threat of Nazism, Stalin had reversed course in December 1933 and embraced Popular Front politics. The USSR joined the League of Nations, belatedly endorsed it as a force to contain fascist Germany, and committed itself to collective security through multilateral treaties with Great Britain and France. "We do not seek an inch of foreign soil," Stalin announced, "nor will we surrender an inch of our own." The Soviet state was intent on using this first large international scientific gathering in Russia to showcase its support for science and collective security against the threat from Nazi Germany. Shock work brigades had completed or renovated scientific institutions and likely sites for visitors in Leningrad and Moscow. The paint was still drying on Koltushi's new dwellings, and a committee of leading state officials and scientists, with Pavlov as official chair, had for many months carefully planned every dimension of the event. "Pavlov looked like a medieval saint," recalled American physiologist John Fulton, as he called the Congress to order at the stunning Tauride Palace and delivered some brief but powerful introductory remarks. The simultaneous translation was excellent, and the English version that came through the earphones was so well-timed to the old man's spirited gesticulations that one fancied he was actually speaking English. The most remarkable thing was to see a man of 86 years presiding over a huge gathering, great floodlights pointing at him, and movies being taken from every direction, all with the fire and enthusiasm of a man of 40. Pavlov's force as personality and symbol combined with the sense of occasion to energize the vast hall. His words were proud, patriotic, and politically pointed. Beginning slowly, he welcomed the delegates and noted the appropriateness of holding the Congress for the first time on Russian soil. The gifts of Sechenov memorabilia honoring the father of Russian physiology should remind visitors that Russian physiology was quite young. Noting the importance of international meetings for popularizing science, he added that, "In Russia, our state now provides enormously great resources for scientific work and attracts masses of youth to science." With this first compliment to the Soviet state, he pivoted toward his main point. "We are all dear comrades, united in many cases by obviously friendly feelings. We are working, obviously, for the rational, decisive unity of mankind. That was now threatened by war, a bestial means of resolving vital difficulties, a means unworthy of the human intellect with its immeasurable resources." These words elicited thunderous applause, after which he continued with a phrase that he had added at the last moment after consultation with Maria Petrova and Commissar of Public Health Grigory Kaminsky. "And I am happy that the government of my mighty homeland, struggling for peace, is the first in history to proclaim not an inch of foreign soil." Physiologists should be especially sympathetic with this position, and, as seekers of truth, we should add that it is necessary to be strictly fair in international relations, and this is the main and real difficulty. Again, applause. He concluded by thanking our government, which has given us the opportunity to receive our dear guests in an honorable manner. Pavlov had gone well beyond a plea for peace. He had endorsed Soviet foreign policy. The second night's banquet, in the throne room of the Catherine Palace at the former Tsarist residence outside Leningrad, proved equally memorable. A gargantuan feast had been laid out for 1,400 people, recalled Fulton, who learned that new kitchens had been installed for the occasion and staffed by 80 chefs and 180 waiters from Moscow. The tables were piled high with elaborate hors d'oeuvres, and at each place were 7 wine glasses, a carafe of vodka, and 2 bottles of wine. When most of the guests were seated, at about 8:30, Pavlov entered to great applause, and the waiters began distributing their delicacies. A hearty ovation greeted the head waiter when he returned with an effigy of Pavlov in clear ice. Pavlov's toast, largely inaudible in the din, captured his own deepest feelings about the event. He celebrated natural science as the main strength of humanity, and physiology as the science that would teach us how correctly to think, feel, and desire, and so provide true happiness to human existence. That last phrase recalls his poem and public speeches during the desperation of spring 1918. Interviewed by an Izvestia correspondent the next day, he amplified his remarks. Physiology had the special obligation to teach people not only how to work, rest, and nourish themselves correctly, but also how to think, feel, and desire correctly. That is, to create a scientific psychology. The Soviet state, he added, understood this. Take my laboratory at Koltushi. The state has spent and is spending much money on Koltushi. An entire scientific village has been built. And so I now constantly worry how we will redeem these expenditures by scientific work. Special trains bore the delegates to Moscow for 2 plenary talks and a final banquet in the Kremlin's Red Hall. Sitting next to Molotov at the head table, Pavlov took the opportunity to inquire skeptically about collectivization and to request that his arrested co-worker, Adlerberg Zotova, and her family be freed. After Molotov's speech, which sounded the now familiar themes of peace, collective security, and the cooperative development of science, Pavlov rose with the first toast in response. He now replayed publicly with Molotov a scene that he had unknowingly rehearsed with Kaminsky and Fedorov during their tour of the IEM on the eve of the Congress. During that rehearsal, the splendid state of the facilities, and Fedorov's rhetorical question, "So you won't be ashamed to show this to your foreign colleagues?" had elicited Pavlov's now standard response. The facilities were wonderful. State support for science was bountiful, and he only hoped that he could justify the expenditures. Now, during the final scene at the Congress, the overwhelming experience of the past 10 days and the task of responding to Molotov's speech served as a powerful stimulus for an identical response. "You have heard and seen the exclusively favorable position that science occupies in our country. I want to illustrate the existing relations between state power and science with just one example. We, the heads of scientific institutions, are anxious and uneasy regarding whether we are able to justify all those resources that our government has made available to us." Molotov responded, as had Kaminsky 10 days earlier. "We are certain that you will unconditionally justify this." Thunderous applause. Pavlov's toast now combined his accumulated sentiments over the past month with the headiness of the moment in his warmest public comments yet about the Soviet state. As you know, I am an experimenter from head to toe. All my life consists of experiments. Our government is also an experimenter, but of an incomparably greater category. I passionately wish to live in order to see the victorious conclusion of this historical social experiment. To rising applause, he raised his glass to the great social experimenters. He had responded to the occasion as he saw fit, given the international threats, his optimism about the growth of Soviet science and its inevitable humanizing consequences, and his own gratitude toward the state, all amplified by constant manipulation and his characteristically passionate response to the moment. Yet, as he had pointedly reminded Molotov in his letter of December 1934, the results of the Bolshevik social experiment were, as with all experiments, unknown, and this one was terribly expensive, and the pained entreaties from its victims kept coming. Pavlov was particularly moved by pleas from those victimized by the campaign against religion. A few weeks after the Congress, he received desperate letters from V.A. Ganoshenko and G.A. Bogomolov, who, along with their families, were among the many priests and children of priests who had been exiled and deprived of the right to a higher education and work. Citing Pavlov's remarks at the Congress about the special obligation of physiologists to teach how correctly to work, to think, to feel, Bogomolov implored him to act on behalf of the Leningrad clergy, to bring some peace to my tormented soul. Such letters led him to protest this current injustice that constantly depresses me in a December 1935 letter to Molotov. Clerical families had produced such leaders of vital truth and progress as Dobrolyubov and Chernyshevsky, more than half of pre-revolutionary Russia's physicians, and many of its scientists, including, of course, Pavlov himself. Why are they all included as members of some typologically exploitative class? I am a free thinker and rationalist of the first order, and have never been any kind of exploiter, and I nevertheless recall my early life with a sense of gratitude, both for the lessons of my childhood and for my schooling. As in earlier responses to Pavlov's letters about repressed individuals, Molotov dismissed his reference to the many unjustly accused, but assured him that Soviet power avidly corrects its real mistakes, suggesting he would look into the particular cases Pavlov mentioned. He also informed him that change was coming. Restrictions on the children of the clergy had earlier been necessary, but now would be lifted. Here, Molotov was providing advance word of the Politburo's impending decision to lift the prohibition against children of various outcast groups receiving a higher education. That news gladdened Pavlov, who saw it as another hopeful sign of increasing reason and moderation. But, as he well knew, this hardly ended the repression of religion. He had told his family for months that he wanted to do something for religion, and now informed Molotov of his intention to send him a principled and lengthy statement about our state atheism. This, then, was the origin of one manuscript that he would labor on while bedridden with what proved a fatal flu during his final winter at Koltushi. Eugenics, primates, and reassessment of the conditional reflex. Pavlov's original plan for Koltushi was, as he informed Molotov, to study the dynamics of the nature-nurture relationship, to determine experimentally on animals the conditions for acquiring, by means of selective breeding, a greatly improved nervous system, for the use and glory, first and foremost, of my homeland. That research, he informed a reporter, should lead to the success of eugenics, the science of the development of a better human type. For Pavlov, like many geneticists in the 1920s and 1930s, eugenics was the logical, practical extension of genetics, and, as for thinkers of almost every ideological stripe, a rational application of science to improve medicine and society. Pavlov envisioned a eugenics that would encourage scientifically informed, voluntary individual behaviors to compensate for hereditary weaknesses and benefit one's offspring. This made especially good sense for him, given his long-standing visceral belief in the inheritance of acquired characteristics, the subject of experiments at Koltushi by his close associate Evgeny Ganike. He condemned Nazi eugenics and observed repeatedly that neither current knowledge of heredity nor the sensitivity of cultured man justified mandatory sterilization. This grand vision, then, integrated several basic interests: the interplay of nature-nurture, the nature and improvement of the Russian type, and humans' individual and collective human struggle against slučajnost, for control of their own destiny. As he put it in a private note, fate, the social struggle with it, practice, eugenics. Research at Koltushi began in fall 1928, when co-workers Stanislav Virshikovsky and Fedor Mayerov divided two litters of four puppies each into two groups of imprisoned and free dogs. The former remained always in the kennel, whereas the latter roamed freely, interacting with nature, other animals, and people. After about 1 year, the experimenters compared their behavior, personalities, and responses to CR experiments. For Pavlov, the sharp differences in the performance of the two groups confirmed his analysis of Garsik and himself. Life experience mattered. The free dogs were enthusiastic, affectionate, and active. The prisoners were pathetic cowards that failed to engage with their environment. Among people, too, he noted, life in a hothouse setting often left those with a strong nervous system in a craven state. Interestingly, prisoners generally performed better in CR experiments, though free dogs more quickly accomplished differentiations. This research, however, soon bogged down. The building of special kennels proceeded slowly, and further experiments awaited the lengthy process of breeding successive generations to obtain pure types. Furthermore, Pavlov admittedly lacked a precise approach to identifying the hereditary factors for which to select. Most important, he could not breed pure types without a reliable typology. At a meeting in September 1933, he announced that the doctrine of types must be placed on firm foundations, but soon admitted that everywhere we are seized by hesitation about the type of nervous system of this or that dog. He collaborated with Mayerov on a set of 21 tests for the nervous type, but these yielded contradictory diagnoses for many dogs and mapped poorly on their behavior and personality. Yet, Koltushi had moved to the very center of Pavlov's emotional life as a scientific center, a country home, and the repository of dreams for his remaining years. So it proved quite fortuitous when, in summer 1933, the arrival of two unexpected guests, the chimps, Rosa and Raphael, provided a new, engrossing scientific rationale for his sojourns to the science village. That arrival was neither Pavlov's idea nor happy chance. It resulted from the scientific ideological agenda of the communists in his lab. They hoped that the exposure to primates might convert the chief from the reductionist, mechanistic views he had imbibed in the 1860s to a more dialectical conception of higher nervous activity, and might encourage his recent tendency to complement his long-standing, narrowly analytic focus on the dynamics of individual reflexes with attention to the systemic qualities of the cortex that separated dog from human. As they knew from experience, arguing philosophy with him was useless, but as a committed and observant experimenter, Pavlov could be moved by the spontaneous dialectics of facts. Engagement with primates might, then, convince him of the qualitative differences between them and lab dogs. Pavlov's communists had for years attempted unsuccessfully to lure him to the Sukhumi primate station, where several of them were conducting CR experiments on the synthetic qualities of its inhabitants. Since Mohammed would not go to the mountain, communist co-worker Peter Denisov brought the mountain to Mohammed. Dispatched by the Academy of Sciences to Serge Voronoff's primate colony on France's Côte d'Azur, he returned with the two chimps as a gift for the chief. Rosa and Raphael engaged Pavlov's curiosity. He began immediately to observe and experiment on them in collaboration with Denisov and, beginning in fall 1933, did so during regular Friday sojourns to Koltushi and lengthier stays during summer and winter breaks. This first sustained contact with a model organism other than the dog would indeed have profound consequences for his ideas about CRs and psychology. Lured into the chimp's arms, Pavlov had his own long-maturing reasons to embrace them. He was preoccupied with the challenge to associationism by Gestalt theorists, led by Wilhelm Kohler, who made effective use of his experiments with chimps. Gestaltists argued that the human mind engages the world not by accumulation and association of small perceptions, but rather by grasping wholes, configurations, or Gestalten. The key concept here was insight, the active apprehension of the structure of an entire perceptual field that lurked beyond simple experiences. After hearing Kohler's address to the International Psychology Congress in 1929, Pavlov began reading his Mentality of Apes, 1917, and Gestalt Psychology, 1929-1933, criticizing them with increasing intensity as Gestalt's popularity grew and its advocates targeted his own CR-based associationism. The first year and a half of Denisov and Pavlov's experiments with Rosa and Raphael were based largely on those that Kohler had described in Mentality of Apes, as Pavlov wanted to examine Kohler's evidence for ascribing to chimps insight that was inexplicable in associationist terms. In 1930-32, Pavlov had developed his concepts of systematicity and the dynamic stereotype to provide an associationist explanation of phenomena that the Gestaltists attributed to the mind's active, holistic insight into the structure of an entire perceptual field. Two basic experiments underlay these concepts. If a series of CRs was established in the dog, the buzzer as a conditional stimulus, a flashing light as a conditional inhibitor, and so forth, any variation in the order of those exciters changed its response to each. The animal, then, responded not just to a single stimulus, but also to the system of stimuli as a whole. A second experiment demonstrated that once this series was established, the first conditional stimulus alone elicited the same series of salivary responses as did exposure to the entire set. Only after a few such trials did the new circumstances elicit a change in these responses, an alteration in the dynamic stereotype, Pavlov's awkward term for expressing that this system was changeable yet durable, exercising an inertial influence of the whole over the parts. Systematicity and the dynamic stereotype, then, were Pavlov's associationist alternatives to the Gestaltist's perceptual field and active subject. Pavlov had earlier worked almost exclusively from the bottom to the top, from the parts to the whole, from the dynamics of isolated individual reflexes toward a characterization of higher nervous activity, behavior, and the psyche. Now, he sought also to move from the top to the bottom, from the whole to the parts, from the dynamic stereotype to its component individual reflexes. Earlier, he had compared unconditional reflexes to a direct line between two telephones, and CRs to a temporary connection established through a switchboard, the cerebral cortex. Now, his attention was shifting toward the switchboard itself. This change was reflected and facilitated by a new metaphor. The long-standing image of chains of reflexes remained, but was increasingly subsumed within that of the cortex as a mosaic with the glittering light of excited cortical points, the darkness of inhibited ones, and the grays formed by the traces of past experiences. The mosaic metaphor, which first appeared in Pavlov's brief discussion of systematicity in his monograph of 1927, made it easier to envision a different kind of nervous connection. Not just that, between a subcortical unconditional stimulus and a cortical conditional stimulus, but also multiple linkages between various cortical points of the mosaic. For example, between two indifferent stimuli, such as a light and a metronome, that were unconnected to any unconditional reflex, and so had no status as signals. Innumerable stimuli constantly bombarded the cerebral hemispheres, Pavlov now emphasized, and these emanated both from the external world and from the animal's own internal milieu. This latter addition reflected his interaction with Polish Pavlovian Jerzy Konorski, who impressed upon Pavlov the existence of a second type of CR, which he termed motor conditioning, as opposed to Pavlov's classical conditioning. Skinner would later describe Konorski's motor CR as instrumental or type 2 conditioning. When Konorski simultaneously fed a dog and moved its leg, a CR was formed, and the dog eventually moved its own leg toward that same goal. As Pavlov put it in 1932, there is this everyday fact, reproduced by us in the laboratory, the formation of a temporary connection between any external excitation and passive movements, with the result that the animal makes active movements in response to certain signals. These developments encouraged Pavlov, as an unwavering believer in both determinism and free will, to think that the two could be reconciled, that free will could be reconceptualized as a result of the summative activity of the cortex, which humans could learn to alter through the direction of energies. He tested that hypothesis in introspective experiments on his own ability to control the otherwise unpredictable direction of his thoughts and desires. This, then, was the context for Rosa and Raphael's arrival at Koltushi. First, repeating Kohler's experiments, and then devising his own, led Pavlov both to deepen his critique of Gestalt's mysticism and, in synergy with his earlier ideas and experiments concerning systematicity, to re-examine and then fundamentally amend his own views. While rejecting Kohler's argument that anthropoids displayed a qualitatively different form of intelligence than that of dogs, Pavlov now recognized important differences between the two organisms that influenced their intellect and learning behavior. At one of his regular Wednesday gatherings with co-workers in September 1934, he noted that the anthropoids' four limbs allowed them to enter into very complex relations with objects, and so to form a mass of associations, which does not exist in other animals. The chimp was an ideal tightrope walker, and watching it confirm empirically the stability of stacked boxes, one saw the complex interplay of its multifold associations, tactile, muscular, visual, and so forth. Whether roaming Koltushi freely or tackling experimental tasks, Rosa and Raphael constantly displayed the multidimensionality of their interaction with the environment, simultaneously manipulating, inspecting, and smelling objects and people in their domain. Pavlov soon realized that, regardless of its species characteristics, the experimental dog harnessed to the stand and exposed to one stimulus at a time could only manifest some of its qualities. Constrained by experimental design, that dog embodied his long-standing model of the organism responding serially to single stimuli. The unconstrained chimp, however, was free to express its powerful investigative instinct simultaneously with eyes, ears, nose, and hands, and so embodied the emerging model of systematicity and the multidimensional mosaic. In early 1935, Pavlov gathered his thoughts in a never-completed manuscript on the intellect of anthropoid apes. Here, he confidently repeated his comments at the Wednesday meetings about Kohler's fallacies and the explicability of chimps' problem-solving process in terms of associations. He was much less confident, however, doing so in terms of CRs. This was a crucial distinction. For Pavlov, a CR was the temporary connection between a subcortical and cortical point, or, as he sometimes put it, between an unconditional exciter of the subcortex, such as food, pain, and sex, and a neutral stimulus, such as a buzzer, light, or metronome, that became a signal for this subcortical exciter by simultaneously exciting a point in the cortex. These specific physiological features underlay the laws governing the CR and its biological role as the mechanism through which organisms adapted to a changing environment. Association was a looser, more general term, a reference to any connection between two or more experiences, sensations, or images. Pavlov had long argued that the physiologist's CR and the psychologist's association referred to the objective and subjective aspects of the same process. But now he was not so sure. In The Intellect of Anthropoid Apes, he analyzed the elementary associations or knowledge or ideas involved when the chimp piled boxes to reach a high-hanging fruit. He identified 10, describing some in more detail than others in this rough draft intended for his eyes only. Here, in paraphrase, is his list, with direct citations of some notes to himself. 1. Boxes must stand directly under the fruit. 2. They must be placed upon the other. But how? 3. The chimp crawls onto the box to test its stability. 4. It moves a second box near, places it on the first box, and tests for stability by crawling on the boxes. This is a kinesthetic association. 5. When a number of boxes are piled up, it tests for stability by inspecting the boxes. And instead of the kinesthetic association, there is another visual association. 6. Over time, the chimp looks at the structure from a greater distance to see if it is of sufficient height. 7. The chimp tests the height by climbing on the boxes. 8. If rectangular boxes are used in the trial, the chimp might reach the necessary height without using all the boxes. 9. If the boxes are not rectangular, the chimp needs to use all 6 boxes. 10. If boxes of various sizes are used in the trial, the chimp must undertake the difficult task of stacking them in the correct order, a process that is probably governed by sight. There was no need, then, to resort to Kohler's insight or other, as he often fulminated to co-workers, gestaltist nonsense. In this visible and indubitable act of thinking, there is nothing other than simple and complex associations. But what was the nature and mechanism of these associations? As Pavlov wrote in the margin of his manuscript, what is united with what? Pavlov referred to a lawful chain of these associations, that is, the association of associations. But what he described was not so much a chain as an interconnected mosaic. The elementary associations are united among themselves in the most varied way, giving rise to a system of nervous processes that with repetition is implemented more and more easily, becoming more and more fixed. The key problem, again, was what is united with what? The association of associations he described differed fundamentally from his old definition of the CR as a temporary connection between a subcortical and cortical point, a signal established through simultaneity. Rather, he repeatedly invoked the connection between, for example, the chimp's kinesthetic and visual associations. He could explain the chimp's complex interaction with its environment and its progress toward a high-hanging fruit by the association of associations, systematicity, and the cortical mosaic. But this explanation drove a wedge between the allegedly synonymous association and CR. Having pondered this problem for 6 months while traveling and presiding over the International Congress of Physiology, in November 1935, he dropped a bombshell on his co-workers. Contrary to 3 decades of lab doctrine, CR and association were not synonymous. The CR was but one type of association. This raised new, pressing research questions. What are the different types of association and their laws? What are the dynamics and mechanisms of systematicity? Closing the meeting, he left his stunned co-workers with a question that they had long considered closed. What is a conditional reflex?